This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Thursday, March 30th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Donald Trump likes to say that his energy policy will bring back jobs and foster energy independence. On Tuesday, he signed an executive order meant to inaugurate that effort. His wider ambition is to slash President Obama's initiatives on global warming. Flanked by a group of miners, he spoke at the EPA.
The miners told me about the attacks on their jobs and their livelihoods. They told me about the efforts to shut down their mines, their communities, and their very way of life. I made them this promise. We will put our miners back to work. We've already eliminated a devastating anti-coal regulation, but that was just the beginning. Today, I'm taking bold action to follow through on that promise. My administration is putting an end to the war on coal. We're going to have clean coal, really clean coal.
Robert Stavins, the director of the Harvard Project on Climate Agreements, joins me to discuss what's wrong with Trump's environmental agenda and the obstacles in its way. Welcome back, Rob.
Hi, Dorothy. Happy to be with you.
I think the last time you were here and we were talking about this subject, Obama was president, you were at work on the Paris Agreement, and climate change deniers seemed to be in retreat. You were feeling pretty optimistic at the time.
Things have changed.
Okay. We will leave it at that. So let's start with the president's photo op on Tuesday. What is wrong with his promise to promote energy independence and economic growth? Seems unobjectionable.
Well, there is nothing about the executive order that really strikes at the so-called energy independence, and also it's really not an economic growth or jobs package. Much of it is really addressed to one sector of the economy, which is the coal industry, which has been in decline. It's been in decline for decades in terms of employment levels. And that's because of two factors. One is technological change. There's been increasing productivity in coal mining, and hence, while in some cases coal extraction was increasing, nevertheless, employment was falling. In addition to that, a big element of it is that reliance on coal in the U.S. has switched to a large degree from Appalachia, deep underground mining, which is very labor-intensive, to surface mining in the Powder River Basin in Wyoming, which is highly capital intensive. So that's led to a fall in employment. And then finally, over more recent years, natural gas prices have fallen tremendously in the United States due to the combination of two technologies, horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing, or so-called fracking. That's brought down natural gas prices, which has resulted in a massive shift in electricity generation from majority reliance on coal to natural gas.
Trump called the Clean Power Plan, which was the heart of Obama's initiative, a crushing attack on American industry. Is that how industry see it?
No, on the contrary, actually. I'd say although one sector, again, the coal industry, does see it that way. But if you're looking more broadly, if you look at fossil fuels in general, look at the major oil companies, they're well diversified into natural gas. So they actually viewed it as to some degree a positive because the Clean Power Plan would have accelerated the movement from coal to petroleum to natural gas and renewables. If you go outside of the fossil fuel industry to electricity generation, their view is, we know that climate policy is going to be coming down the line. The Clean Power Plan is a relatively flexible approach. They prefer a flexible approach to an inflexible one. And so they were coming around in most parts of the United States.
Why did the Clean Power Plan end up in the Supreme Court? What's the challenge there?
So the problem really is that the Clean Air Act itself was not written to deal with global environmental problems or even transboundary ones, but with local environmental pollution such as smog. Because of that, when the George H.W. Bush administration wanted to address acid rain, which is transboundary, comes from Ohio and winds up getting deposited in Maine, they realized they needed to amend the law, and those were the Clean Air Act amendments of 1990. Likewise, the Obama administration, when they wanted to deal with climate change, with carbon dioxide emissions, because those are a global pollutant, they recognized they needed a statutory approach. They couldn't do it under the Clean Air Act as it was written. They tried that after health care had passed. They tried next the Waxman-Markey legislation. It passed the House. It failed in the Senate. Because of that, President Obama, particularly in his second term, said, okay, I'm going to do what I can without the Congress because they're not cooperating. I'm going to use executive orders and regulatory approaches. So the Clean Power Plan is a regulatory approach. But even legal defenders of the Clean Power Plan will tell you that it's really taking the Clean Air Act into places it's not been. So that's why it was challenged, and that's why it wound up in the before the Supreme Court.
This seems to be a widespread misperception about the Republican Party and its history on environmental issues. So Republicans actually have often played a crucial role in finding market-based solutions to environmental problems. You just cited the Clean Air Act. Talk a little bit more about that history and how we ended up with a Republican president who has stated that climate change is a hoax by the Chinese.
It's true that the history of the Republican Party, if we go back all the way to Teddy Roosevelt, but much more recently, actually, to Richard Nixon, was the party that was very conservationist and environmentally informed. The major environmental statutes in the United States, the five of them, that come from the period approximately the beginning of the environmental movement, 1970, the first Earth Day, were passed under the Republican administration of Richard Nixon and came from the Democratic Congress. Fast forward to the administration of George H.W. Bush, and what they observed was that they wanted to deal with environment, but in what they thought was an economically responsible way. They were the first administration, even more than the Reagan administration, which also moved in that direction a bit, to want to use so-called market-based approaches to environmental protection. That phrase, using the market to protect the environment, is sort of a statement of what previously was the quintessential position of the Republican Party on environmental issues.
Getting back for a second to Trump's claim that his plan will create jobs, wouldn't the Clean Power Plan of Obama have created more jobs than Trump's proposal?
So I think what it's fair to say is that the Clean Power Plan would have resulted in increases in jobs in some sectors and losses in jobs in other sectors. We would have seen a shift from coal to natural gas and then to renewables. It's a shift that's already underway, and it would have been accelerated somewhat. It's quite possible that there would have been a net increase in employment as a result, but the numbers are relatively small. That shouldn't have been the motivation. It wasn't the motivation for the Clean Power Plan. Likewise, in terms of the executive order, I don't see significant impacts on employment. If it were really implemented in full, the seven parts of it, which I don't think will happen, we would see, again, gains and losses in employment. But nothing like the president is talking about. This is not a jobs policy.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
What about Scott Pruitt, who we all know is a climate change skeptic? He's the new head of the EPA. Democrats and environmentalists are really alarmed by him. Many see him as maybe the scariest of Trump's cabinet appointments.
Well, I'm reminded of Ann Gorsuch, who was the first administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency under Ronald Reagan. And she came in from a background not completely unlike Pruitt, in which working at the state level, in her case, as I recall, it was Colorado, was very opposed to federal environmental regulation. She was brought in to run EPA. There was disarray. She got in a lot of trouble, and she wound up resigning after, I think it was 18 months. They're similar in terms of having very much an adversarial background. Now, having an adversarial background, by the way, is not surprising. That happens in Democratic administrations as well. The advocates tend to come from environmental advocacy groups. But Pruitt really does stand out in terms of having led the effort among state attorneys general over the past several years in opposition to Obama climate policies. As an environmental economist, you know, my view is that some regulations make sense, some don't. If the benefits are greater than the costs, they basically make sense for the country as a whole. That's been the position of the Office of Management and Budget going back to the presidency of Jimmy Carter. We have a process of regulatory impact analysis in the U.S. going back to Ronald Reagan. So that's been consistent across administrations. This administration came in, and in a previous executive order that's now probably a month old that was titled Reducing Regulation and Controlling Regulatory Costs, they've completely turned that on its head. What they said instead is only look at the cost of regulations. Well, that makes absolutely no sense. If you throw out the most costly regulation, you could be throwing out the one that has the greatest difference of surplus of benefits above cost. They also said that for any new regulation that's put in place, two have to be thrown out. Now, that's something from a television show. I mean, that is just absolutely childish thinking compared to what, again, every president going back to Ronald Reagan has done within the regulatory sphere. Some Republicans, some Democrats, some aggressive on regulation, some not aggressive on regulation. But this is actually childish. I don't know what else to characterize this two-for-one idea.
Trump is beginning and Congress are beginning to turn to the federal budget. What could be done legislatively that would cut the budget and be good for the environment?
Well, if there was concern about budgetary deficits and they wanted to address that, then one way certainly to address that would either be to focus on carbon, because that's a big issue for the country, and to address it either with a tax on carbon, in other words, on the three fossil fuels, coal, petroleum, and natural gas, or with an analogous cap-and-trade system in which the allowances aren't given away by the government. They're auctioned. They're sold. Either of those would raise massive amounts of revenue, and then rather than taxing and punishing fundamentally desirable activity, namely labor through income taxes and investment through taxes on capital and investment directly, we'd be taxing an undesirable activity, namely pollution.
Getting back to climate change, Trump said during the campaign that he would cancel the Paris Climate Agreement. What does he mean? Can the U.S. cancel this agreement?
The fact is that the United States can't tear up the Paris Agreement. It can't, in fact, even renegotiate the Paris Agreement. The Paris Agreement has come into force. It did on November 4th of last year, 4 days before the election. And as a result of that, for an individual country to withdraw, if that's what he meant, if he wanted to withdraw from the Paris Agreement, it would take essentially 4 years after that date. In other words, it can't happen during this first year of the administration. In fact, in my view, the reason why the Paris Agreement came into force so quickly, which was only 1 year after the Paris negotiations, was that countries of the world rushed to ratify it because they were afraid of what would happen if it hadn't come into force and Mr. Trump was elected. So in that sense, President Trump has actually done something marvelous for the world, in that we can attribute the Paris Agreement having come into force to the threat of his presidency.
I think you were in Marrakesh, actually, just after the election, when some of the details of the Paris Treaty were being worked out. How did negotiators respond to the news of Trump's election?
Well, it ranged between traumatized and accepting. It was one of those situations, as it continues to be. I was just in Europe a few days ago, that you meet with someone that you haven't seen for a while. Your purpose is a particular technical discussion. You have a half hour, but then the first 10 to 20 minutes are taken up by lamenting the fact that Donald Trump has been elected president. So that it happened over and over again. People were very worried. They were very, very concerned because the United States and China are the most important contributors to climate change. Together, they're about 40% or so of global emissions. And so there was a lot of concern about Mr. Trump going through with these threats. But one of the things I saw very quickly and has been validated since then is that the other important party, namely China, they weren't stepping back. Rather, all the negotiators I met from in China and the head of state there, the president, has since reaffirmed it, is that China, quote unquote, will no longer have co-leadership with the United States. That's unfortunate, but we are delighted to have sole leadership. And they're moving ahead aggressively, and they almost appear to be quite pleased with the situation.
Give us some hope here at home. What can be done on the state level?
Well, it's unlikely that state efforts would completely make up for what's being done. In fact, we could just take the Clean Power Plan. So if we remove the Clean Power Plan, as appears will likely happen, is it likely that state actions will fully compensate for that? And no, the answer is no to that. However, what is true is something that I think is analogous to what I said about international action. The level of ambition from California, Oregon, Washington, some of the Northeast states, and some of the upper Midwest will be greater than what it would have been absent the Trump administration. And we saw that immediately from Jerry Brown in California. They're seeking now to extend their 2006 law, the Global Warming Solutions Act, with very aggressive targets. It was already the most aggressive climate policy in the U.S. They're linking with Quebec and Ontario in Canada. Oregon and Washington are going forward with climate policies. It looks like likely cap and trade. There may be a mix with carbon taxes. And in the Northeast, there's talk about increasing the stringency of the policy that exists among nine states called the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. Not surprisingly, it's been the state of Vermont that's always been very active. And now I would say the state of New York is the one. New York is also, of course, the largest of the states, the largest of the emitters. They're very important. They have an administration that's aggressive and very interested in climate change.
Okay, thank you so much, Rob. We'll get you back in a couple of months.
I hope I have something more positive to say.
I do too.
Okay.
Robert Stavins is the director of the Harvard Project on Climate Agreements. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on NewYorker.com. Feel free to rate and review The Political Scene on iTunes. This podcast is produced by Alex Barron for NewYorker.com with help from Daniel Wenger. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.